Imagine a world where forming policy was less about cutting through red tape and more about listening to people for building a better tomorrow. Two of the most widely discussed issues facing our society today center around climate and economic inequality. While many people are divided on these issues, there are a variety of ideas involving how they should be handled. We were curious to know what the younger generation thought about these topics. So in May 2021, we brought together more than 600 young people from across the country, some students, some non-students, some just out of high school, others closer to their 30th birthdays. They were all brought together online to discuss their insights on these issues in small groups. They then listened to panels of experts that answered their questions and interacted with each other, regardless of whether they agreed on the topics being discussed. From the team that brought you Voices of America in One Room, this is Voices of Shaping Our Future.
My name is Alice. I'm the Associate Director at the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University.
In our final episode this season, we conclude Voices of Shaping Our Future by sitting down with a group of thought leaders for a roundtable discussion about economic inequality. Let's meet our panelists.
My name is Roger Nathaniel. I'm the Chief of Staff and Policy Advisor to Mayor Kevin Lincoln in Stockton, California. I was actually born and raised in Stockton, California, so that's where I call home. It's where I'm at now.
I'm Rachel Gentry, and I am the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's Finance Fellow, and I am currently working for Representative Horsford's office from Nevada, but since I'm working remote, I'm currently in my hometown of Houston, Texas.
I am Yaakov Fagan. I am the Associate Director in the Bergeron Institute's Future of Capitalism program, and I am based in Los Angeles.
I moderated this discussion, so let's jump right into the conversation.
Welcome to the podcast Roundtable on Economic Inequality. I'm so happy to have three distinguished guests with us today. And today we really get to deep dive into what economic inequality means and talk a bit more about the specific policy proposals that the participants at Shaping Our Future talked about, including minimum wage, universal basic income, and hearing the experts' views here on some of the tough questions our participants were struggling with. Economic inequality is definitely one of the most heated topics. It's always on top of our minds in our day-to-day life when we're trying to make ends meet. And, you know, minimum wage and universal basic income ignited a lot of arguments and got people thinking about what their own opinions are. Some people brought up fairness and equity. Other people talked about how important it was to have a safety net and to be inclusive. So before we deep dive into these difficult issues, I'd love our guests today here, Rachel, Yaakov, Raj, to talk about what your impressions are on these economic issues, specifically minimum wage and universal basic income. Are these policies that you've seen kind of come and go in our society? Is it something that we should be supporting, opposing, or are we just really kind of unsure about? I think many of our listeners want to figure out what those pros and cons are for themselves. I'm going to start off today. Yaakov, I see you're unmuting your microphone. Do you want to go first and kick us off here?
Sure, the unmute was preemptive in case I forgot to unmute, which I do a lot. I think we're dealing with two different sets of problems, right? I'll start with minimum wage. I think minimum wage is really fascinating because, you know, if you surveyed the American Economics Association, which is not the end all be all of economic policy thought, but let's just say as a sample, you would find in 1990, you would find a strong majority opposed to minimum wage laws. If you did that today, you would find a strong majority in support of minimum wage laws. And one And the reasons, and actually the only reason for that, I would say, is that minimum wage is one of those areas in which the empirical revolution in economics, or supporters would call it a revolution, others wouldn't, but essentially has changed people's minds. You know, standard mainstream economic theory, which I am not an exponent of, by the way, used to think that minimum wage would always lower employment, right? John Maynard Keynes said that was wrong in as early as 1936, and we ignored him. But afterwards, for a series through the 90s, and especially in 2000, in the 2000s, a series of studies, very good ones, increasingly found that minimum wage does not lower employment. In fact, it might increase it. Right. And the evidence has become so heavy that that old kind of thinking has really come, has really, even in the mainstream of the profession, of the discipline, has really begun to change. Our minimum wage itself hasn't really moved at all, especially in line with part of the increasing productivity of the American worker. Right. On UBI, I've gone from slightly skeptical to agnostic to actually being somewhat supportive and maybe even strongly supportive, especially after the CARES Act went through, because I think that was a very good, I use the CARES Act as a kind of embracing term for all the pandemic support, income support. That was a really good demonstration that just giving people money happens to cut poverty and not, and sustain and maybe even expand the level of consumption, which leads to increased economic growth. So I've become pretty pro universal basic income in abstract.
Thank you. Let's go to Rachel.
I believe I agree with Yaakov when it comes to the universal basic income on an abstract point of view, because the CARES Act really did help with providing the stimulus packages to families, but there was a certain criteria that it had to meet. Versus universal basic income is just everyone gets, you know, an allowance in a certain sense per month. But, you know, if you just keep it on the universal basic income, how everybody looks at it, like plain, everyone gets money, but certain amounts of money could go to the rich that don't really need, I guess, $1,000 or $500 a month, however they want to set that monetary, standard. So I agree with having a UBI, but having certain criteria and giving it to certain people who may really need it. So I'm for it, but it needs to be tweaked on how the policy is probably implemented. When it comes to minimum wage, I'm all for minimum wage. But in a way, I can kind of understand how people believe that it would get rid of small businesses, depending on how high the standard of minimum wage would be. Because a lot of small businesses, especially in rural areas, cannot afford to do the $15 an hour for their workers. So I believe minimum wage should... it should be set on a federal, but as well have like a more regional type of research behind it to see who needs to have a certain amount of money in certain areas to afford a two-bedroom household for single mothers who have kids that currently cannot afford a modest two-bedroom household off of minimum wage working 40 hours. So I am for both, but the policy needs to be a little tweaked a little bit before we actually implement these policies.
Yeah, Rachel, your sentiments. I heard a lot from the participants. Raj, you're from Stockton, and I know that Stockton has been this test bed of the UBI. You've definitely probably got some, you know, on the ground experience here.
Yeah, so it's actually quite interesting. The UBI experiment in Stockton, a lot of people don't know, it actually wasn't through the official city of Stockton government. It was actually through a private foundation that the former mayor also had influence and I think a position with as well, and I believe created. And so You know, I'm 100% Stockton's probably biggest fan. I love Stockton. So anytime that there's innovation, any sort of creative policy experiment, I want it to be here in town. I think we have, in 2020, we were voted, or through a study, we're the most diverse city in the country. This is a great test site for any sort of policy. And so UBI is absolutely fascinating. It is an interesting proposition. And I think, you know, coming on the heels of COVID-19 and riding this wave of the stimulus packages and those one-time payments that some of these families are getting, I think it gained a lot of traction. And I think it does have a lot of potential to assist individuals who genuinely are working their hardest and still not being able to make ends meet. You know, it's I think some of the opposition, unfortunately, and this is true of some individuals and not others, you know, they think that it is their fault that they are in the predicament that they're in. You know, unfortunately, life deals people different hands. And I think UBI can help bridge that gap, but it needs to be amended. I think universal payments just for, you know, eating, breathing, and being able to think is something that can be a little bit problematic. And I think from a spending standpoint as well, government spending standpoint, I want to make sure that we're not making it, putting these people in a position at a disservice where at one point we're going to have to pull out the rug from under them because it's not a sustainable policy. I think that's going to do more harm than good. I'm all about creating value. How can we incentivize individuals and teach individuals to create something for themselves? And maybe it could be tied to some sort of training. I know when people say, you know, I can't go to X, Y, and Z program to receive the training because I can't afford to do it. If you use UBI as an incentive, as a sort of incentive for somebody to go to a program, so they can afford to take time off of work, potentially pay for their child to be watched, so they're not losing out, and now you're increasing the opportunity costs and benefits, I think that could have some real potential. So it does have a place somewhere in the policy arena, but as a blanketed payment system, I don't think it's sustainable, and I think it could be potentially problematic. In terms of a minimum wage, I think it's interesting. So a little bit about myself. My parents immigrated from the Fiji Islands. They came here to really, you know, improve on their education and really understand what they're doing and how they could benefit society. And so my grandmother worked minimum wage since she got here, and it slowly moved up. You know, all my parents worked minimum wage jobs. I even worked minimum wage jobs. I think it's a good thing. But, you know, and every single business owner that I talk to here in Stockton and just across the country, there is quite a concern about the feasibility of a mandated wage at that high of a level, at that $15 mark. And I think if the federal government were to potentially increase it a little bit more slowly, a little bit more gradually, and even at a lower level and setting a lower threshold, I think it could give a little bit more flexibility to these small business owners, particularly who are the backbone of our economy, to make the decisions that they need to make and not have it be as drastic of a change. But the unfortunate truth is people are working their butts off trying to make a living, and unfortunately they're not able to. So something has to be done. But that $15 mark for me, I'm a little bit unsure. I'm a little bit concerned.
Thank you for sharing that, Raj, and sharing that on the ground experience. And I just have to follow up for some of our listeners. I didn't know that the Stockton UBI program was, you know, not from the government. So does that mean it's ending? What does that mean for the people that are receiving those that income right now?
Right. And so last time I checked, they had extended it for a period of time, but these are not government payments. This is through private foundations and private donors. And so, again, the feasibility of maintaining this, the pilot program was great in terms of getting results and understanding data and what's happening and how those dollars are being used. But again, it calls into the question of, okay, how sustainable could something like these payments be to these individuals? I know it helped now. And, you know, unfortunately, I think when an individual received that payment and you know that it's going to be a baseline payment, I kind of treat it as a fluctuation in their mindset. Now I can afford X, Y, and Z. This is how our lifestyle is going to shift a little bit. And forcing somebody to revert back to their original position, for me, I think that sort of instability can be problematic. And if done at the national scale, it can be quite tragic.
So I want to really talk about fairness and equity. And we can talk about with respect to UBI or minimum wage or both. This came up a lot with our participants during the discussions. And on some participants talked about the amount being unfair in terms of just the number, whether it's $1,000, whether it's $15, when we're talking about wage. And they said that, you know, if I live in San Francisco, $1,000 does not go as far as living in small town somewhere. And that same thing applies for $15 blanket wage. And folks just thought, well, that's not fair. Like, I'm living here, I should get more. And other people judged the fact that, well, different people have different needs. And maybe someone that has greater needs should get more money. And one participant talked about, well, you should just think about it as how much people are willing to work for, and think about fairness that way. And as Rachel and others you've talked about here, you know, another participant said that some of this income are lifelines and will lift people out of poverty, as you've mentioned, you know, with the CARES Act. But everyone agrees that something needs to be done. But people are also concerned about doing it in a way that's fair and equitable. And it's really complicated to think about it that way. And I think many people, many folks in the as participants were just kind of confused as they really dug into the specifics of it. Yaakov, you raised your hand. I'm going to you.
Yeah, I mean, to understand, I think, fairness, right? I think it's really important to understand the economics of the policies and some of the underlying assumptions. The rural-urban divide, it's very real, but I think we need to kind of think about what drives it in the first place in order to understand whether these policies can be sustained in a low-output area or rural area. I think, and with no ill intention, people, including in this session, are coming about it from the wrong angle. Why are rural, there's this assumption that rural areas can't handle a minimum wage because higher minimum wage or higher payouts because they are poorer. The question is, why are they poorer, right? And a large portion of that is people get paid less than them. And because of that, there is a feedback into the demand of the economy, the demand side, right? People will spend less relative to San Francisco. And that feeds right back into the capacity of the economy to produce new things. If there is no demand for services or goods, then the capitalists will not make them, right? So we call that wage-led growth. And what there is a really brilliant new paper by an economist named Luke Pasek, who just came out, which actually says that, you know, the problem in a lot of American areas is that they are under capacity because they're paying, their wages are far too low. And that actually, you know, that really coincides with other empirical research. When minimum wages go up, actually not that we have higher unemployment, is that we get a redistribution of labor from lower efficiency firms to higher efficiency firms, right? There is an infamous study in San Francisco where a group of researchers took Yelp reviews, right, of restaurants. They controlled for the menu prices, so like not menu, but you know, the price of the restaurant by dollar sign, and they saw which restaurants stayed open before a minimum wage increase and after a minimum wage increase, and they found that it was only the bad restaurants that closed and the good ones stayed open no matter what the price of the items on the menu were. You find very similar results in studies of minimum wage increases in Germany, where you had labor move from higher to low, from lower to higher efficiency firms. In China, you had the exact same results, right? And that's the problem with trying to regionalize a minimum wage, right? And create these federally introduced, you know, differentials. I'm nervous that locks in the status quo for regions. And I'm nervous that I'll actually drive up the cost of living in more high expense regions as economic activity continues to concentrate in them, without expanding in lower cost regions, right? That creates more of a pull factor. And I think there's been this assumption since the Reaganism in the 1980s that localities have to, you know, compete in a race to the bottom. And that has, I think that's ended disastrously for many communities, right? And I don't think that's a natural outcome. And that should be, and I think we really need a spatial policy and one that actually actively invests in regions to even that out, that damage out. And again, on the UBI, one of the things I am least concerned about is that rich people get it, right? And that's because, okay, first of all, there's a very basic kind of elasticities, right? Like the ability of people to spend, right? For a person with $5, $1 is a major life change, right? That'll change their behavior, that'll change their decision. For a person with $10, it's less of a major life change, right? So if there's a little bit of, you know, undeserved receipt or whatever, it's not a huge deal when it comes to capturing UBI's benefits is for pure simplicity, right? Is the pure simplicity of things that its advocates kind of advocate. As for the budget, I actually don't think the United States in particular has this actual budget constraint. The budget is just an accounting residual. We can print as much money if we want, as long as we sustain fiscal policies that expand capacity, right? These are all political choices. But I'm sorry, coming back to the wealth issue of UBI, the other thing is, if that really concerns you, that shouldn't be a distribution policy, like a welfare policy problem. That should be a tax policy problem, right? If that concerns you that people are getting undeserved UBI, then you just adjust the tax rates, right? And that's how you deal with it while keeping the administrative simplicity of the policy, if that's the policy you're going for. Like I think you need to really be careful about the tools and their implications before you go after them.
Please go ahead, Rachel.
Well, okay. I will say Jakob has a very, very, very distinct and very head-on point. And he did bring up taxes when you have to distribute, you know, money and how, you know, if you're concerned about who gets, $1,000 a month and not having enough for the budget, then that's a tax issue. We've been fighting tax issues for the land before time. And there have been certain policies in place to try to tax the super wealthy, but, you know, like you said, the game of politics sometimes it just doesn't happen like that. So, and to, you know, everybody does believe that we can print as much money as we can, but everybody does not want to print as much money as, you know, America can do with the Federal Reserve and other, government agencies like that. But I do understand that giving somebody money, they're going to do whatever they want to do with it, you know, and it, from a certain standpoint, it wouldn't hurt the budget if there is an actual budget, from a lot of people's point of view. But tax policy is probably one of the hardest policies to go through with on Capitol Hill. And I mean, just look at how, when we tried to give for the CARES Act, it took a lot of things to make it happen. It's for everybody. When are they going to pass the bill to get our stimulus checks? When are they going to pass the bill for that? A lot of it was held up within the Finance Committee because they were trying to figure out how they could distribute this money due to taxes. So, and comparing that to a lot of other programs like welfare, Section 8, there's taxes set aside for that, as well as certain people only can qualify for that. And it's been working for more than 50 years now. So I understand that not trying to just leave out certain people and have it just for certain, like, have a certain standard for who can qualify for a UBI. But sometimes in this frame, I hate using this term, but if the system for this particular area isn't broken on how to distribute the money without causing the United States to be in more debt than it already is, from what people say, don't change it. Now, there's a lot of other systems that need to be fixed, like racism and inequality. So I'm going to put that out there. But when it comes to this particular thing, with this particular issue, you might want to keep it in the same format that we've done welfare, food stamps and other things like that. But, you know, they're already talking about this may phase out food stamps and welfare if we do get a UBI. So I feel like if we are scared about these things being phased out, we might as well try to phase out, but phase in something that can cross paths with it, so we won't be in total shock of what new happens.
Right. Yeah, I think Rachel mentioned a great point. And it's if UBI does come along, there's policymakers that are saying, well, what is it going to replace? Or will it be a supplement to our current system? And I think that is where a lot of disagreement is also happening as well. People talk about UBI, to UBI or not to UBI, right? That's something I like to say in some of my other policy discussions with some of my colleagues. And it's really understanding how it fits in with our current system. Or how it can supplement our current system. And I think that policymakers have a few fronts that they need to decide on. And that is one of the primary questions as well. In terms of fairness and equity, if there's one thing that politics has taught me prior to becoming a chief of staff, I was a campaign manager and a chief strategist. And so you see the political dimension both on the campaign side, but also you see it on the political and governance side as well. Thankfully, Stockton is not as bad as other municipalities. I am blessed to say that it is much less of a headache for myself, but I fear that when people think about equality and fairness, the way that we operationalize it in our minds are, you know, it's dependent upon our experience and what we know and how we grew up, our values as well. You know, somebody on another side of town may think of equality as somebody on another side of town, right? It all depends on that experience that has been at the forefront of academia and the academy, what we're really trying to capture in some of our research. And so my fear is that the political dimension in other areas may begin to alter how we see equity and fairness. We saw groups being pitted against each other quite recently in our political arena. And unfortunately, I think some of that is for political gain. Political opportunism, I think, can degrade, but also I think stifle innovation to an extent. And so when we're thinking about equality and fairness and operationalizing that, I'm just thinking to myself, like, okay, how do I see equality? I think about equal opportunity, first thing, to get to upward mobilization in terms of economic equality for me is the way that I define it. But that's because that's what my parents did. My grandmother was a single mother with three children when her husband unexpectedly died working minimum wage. Her three children, one is a manager at a company, the other one's a corporate executive, and the other one is, my mother is a college professor and counselor, teaching guidance courses at the local community college. And for me, they were on welfare. They utilized the system to get off of the system as well. And I think that that is something that's important. But for me, because I've seen it happen, that's fair. To an extent, it's fair. And unfortunately, as I've grown up, I realized, well, that is becoming a little bit more of the exception rather than the rule. I talk with friends all the time. Well, their definition is completely different from mine because the system didn't work out the way that they wanted it to. So I think people feel that way for a reason. Some people are aggrieved, but it's not coming out of anywhere. These people are feeling that way for a reason. I think we need to acknowledge that and understand that just because your experience is different from somebody else's doesn't invalidate the other person's. And I think once we come to that consensus, we can move towards a better understanding of what is fair. Look, people are going to be upset no matter what definition you choose. You're not going to please everybody. And I think the sooner that we reconcile that fact, the quicker we can actually move towards working and moving on a policy that is actually can be actionable and implemented rather than just talking about it in policy think tanks or just theorizing to the nth degree. If something has to be done, it has to be done quickly, especially coming out of COVID.
Yakov, did you have something you wanted to share?
I just think we need, I think those are really well taken points, but I also think as people who are working on these issues, we should be articulating our own version of fairness and what works best, even if the public doesn't feel that way right now. We need to be, most of my work's on industrial policy, right? Manufacturing work, things like that. And I always have to bluntly tell people, yeah, you may think the free market is working, but look at our trade deficit, right? You have to work for, you know, we talk about budget deficits. People are freaked out about them. That is not, I think, a good idea to freak out about budget deficits, but, you know, years of indoctrination has taught people to fear them. So we have to, as leaders, tell people, hey, maybe their conceptions aren't necessarily right. Here are the alternatives. Here are good reasons. Let's stand for that, right? You know, that's called politics. That's called politics in the proper sense, not just legislative maneuvering, right? And those are two valences of doing something.
I really appreciate the differing views that are coming out here. And Raj, I'm so grateful, you know, and thankful for you sharing, you know, your own personal background and how you see fairness. And I'm jumping on your point of working behast the definition and figuring out something actionable. The current administration has been talking about having a federal minimum wage of $15. Haven't heard about it recently. I heard about it earlier, but is that for real? I mean, the people that are listening, I'm sure, want to know, is that really going to happen? And if so, any tips on when? I see heads shaking. Okay, let's get some answers here for our listeners.
In all honesty, I don't think it will happen anytime soon. Not too sure if it's going to happen in my lifetime, in our lifetime. Because of the fact that when it comes to coming to a common ground when money is involved, it's very hard to do so. Going back to when I worked in a state legislature in Louisiana when I was in law school, I saw a bill being proposed that would let counties set their own minimum wage. And I believe like the standard was you at least have it to $10, $10, $11. And it still got shot down. Now, this was something that gave the counties, well, they call it parishes in Louisiana. It gave each parish the opportunity to set their minimum wage. You had free reign. It still was shot down. It wasn't even $15. And the main reason was because, you know, small businesses were being targeted, talking about how they would lose their income, as well as they didn't want the state telling them what to do sometimes. So it was a lot of things. So going from watching how that bill was argued on the floor and in committee, I really think it would be a hard time to try to pass $15 minimum wage. Because if you can't even do it on a state and local municipality and in parish area, it's going to be hard for DC to try to speak for the rest of the 50 states. You know, in my opinion, and seeing, like I said, seeing from the state of Louisiana, which is one of the poorest states in the United States. So I don't think so. I know they were fighting hard for it. A lot of the congressmen and senators were trying to fight for the $15 minimum. And I believe it was a bipartisanship on that type of legislation, but it didn't have enough backing behind it, in my opinion, looking from outside in.
Right. And I think, yeah, I'm skeptical as well. Just because of DC politics, how it operates. But if we think about what DC is, it's the epicenter of our national politics. There's 50 states, hundreds of representatives, and each of them have a district, have a state, they have particular interests. And their job is to be myopic towards those constituents. That is their number one priority. They're there to serve. There to serve them. Now, there's been kind of a shift. You know, before individuals would speak of politicians as statesmen who are there to be in the interest of the broader country, who are there to serve at the general interest. But I think what people fail to understand when they kind of put that idea forth is that, you know, the general country is not electing that senator from Montana. You know, it's not electing that, you know, congresswoman who is in the 13th district here in California or whatever district that may be. You know, they are here for a particular reason. And that's because they're there to respond to their constituents, because ultimately that's who they're going to be responding to, at the end of the day, I think. And I think that is why it becomes quite complex, especially at a federal level. We have such diverse peoples here, such diverse areas here, diverse state economies. You know, you juxtapose California with a state like Nebraska, you know, a $15 minimum wage one place may not fare, you know, the same, you know, elsewhere. And I think it's an interesting debate that a lot of people are having. But I think I just read recently that CVS, corporations are now taking the lead on increasing the minimum wage on their own. So I think CVS is going to $15 an hour, potentially. Other corporations I've read are doing the same. But these mega corporations, you know, they have the flexibility and the capacity to do so. I'm no economist. I don't pretend to be. But it seems that, you know, even the political discussion itself is leading to some of these corporations to kind of reevaluate, reassess, and kind of take charge in that respect. So I don't think it'll help at a federal level. I think we're going to see different companies do it themselves to a certain degree, but to a certain extent, who employs those individuals at those companies? And, you know, it's going to be uneven. And again, it could impact us residually for years to come.
I mean, I think unfortunately it's going to take a while for us to get a $15 minimum wage. And I think by that time, the justified minimum wage would have to be much higher given the rate of inflation. It probably is higher right now. There are some estimates that if to carry on with historical growth rates, it would have to be 22 an hour actually instead of 15. I slightly disagree with you, Rajan, about the politics here. $15 minimum wage is overwhelmingly popular in the United States. Once it's put to a plebiscite, once it's put to direct democracy, it consistently wins votes, both Republican and Democratic. What I think is going on is twofold. As I mentioned before, you know, the causality that you're using, I think, is going backwards, right? Areas are not performing as well as they are performing, not because they have high minimum wages, but because they have low ones, right? But that benefits certain very powerful local interests, right? Oftentimes interests we code as small business, but on their local scale are massive, right? The companies that would be hurt the most by minimum wages would be large entities like car dealers, for example, which are often local small businesses with extreme political power, right? But aren't exactly productive and aren't exactly struggling because they're living off of cheap labor. And we may not want them to be open actually as a society, right? They're unproductive, they employ cheap labor. We might want people working for CVS, right? But they have an outsized voice in Washington, DC because they have money. And particularly they have local money, so they will go after Congress people. I also think larger corporations take advantage of the fear of small businesses because people react better to a small business than they do to CVS, but CVS does not want to pay that $15 either. Why are they doing it? First of all, voluntary pay increases are not the same thing as a minimum wage. They have different economic effects, but why are they doing it now? They're doing it now because we have labor scarcity, right? Which just means workers are for once getting a fair shake out of this economy for the first time since the 90s, really. Right? And that means businesses have to compete for workers. Why are we having this situation? Well, first of all, we have a lot of people that still have to stay home, take care of their kids. And we've given them the tools to do that through direct cash payments. That's called a tight labor market. That means also we're heading towards full employment. We might be, right? Getting there. That's something that's very different from a minimum wage, but might replicate some of the effects of a minimum wage. And at that point, you know, it comes down to bargaining power because, you know, all of economics, everything is about realistically bargaining and conflict. And at this point, what we've done via the cash injections is we've replicated some of these effects, right? And in turn, that'll actually probably make it actually maybe change the politics of this somewhat, because I think at this point, the large firms will actually want to force everyone else to pay the money. To pay the wages they're starting to be forced to pay, right? But again, it's shocking to me just how popular a $15 minimum wage is, right? Like every time it's gone to referendum, it's won. And I think we have a real democratic deficit, especially in those low wage counties where small groups of elites that benefit off that to run, let's be honest, shitty companies get to keep exploiting those underpaid workers. Companies that shouldn't exist. I think you have a right to be, to get paid your fair shake for work and to have a comfortable life. You don't have a right to own your own business.
I think Yakov, I was going to ask you a question, but you kind of led with it. You know, if there's such popularity for these interests, don't you think it would be in the politicians' interest to support a program like a $15 minimum wage, right? But then you added that, you know, there's this business, you know, corporate donation dimension there that can kind of sway interest. I'm a little bit more optimistic when it comes to some of these businesses. You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, if there's a business that's exploiting somebody or is treating them harshly, you know, I think here in this country, we have free choice and you can leave that company. You know, there's tons of jobs out there right now to a certain extent. I know that's not always the case, but, you know, just because you're in a specific job here, you know, if a business isn't treating somebody extremely well, or if they're, you know, neglecting, you know, the talent that they have there, you know, I'm a firm believer that talent will probably leave. I think here in this country, we have the ability to leave, which is a plus, because I know in other countries, it's not necessarily the case in terms of that flexibility. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, but if a corporation or a company is treating somebody badly, I would think that, you know, they've kind of fall flat on their own face in doing so. I don't think that they have total control in terms of dictating the wage through donations and whatnot. I get it, you know, money talks. You know, I was a campaign manager. I've seen money flow in and out consistently from big name people. And I've seen it, you know, through the Form 460s here in California and other candidates when I'm evaluating their races as well. But, you know, I just think maybe it's just wishful thinking to think that the market will do what it needs to do in that respect. But again, I feel like you've probably studied this more than I have. And I'm looking at it from the local lens here, because I know businesses who didn't treat their patrons quite well, and they're out of business. And, you know, conversely, I can't even count how many grand openings the mayor and other politicians here in the area have been through in amidst COVID. You know, so I think that, you know, I just think we need to be a little bit weary about, you know, just saying that, you know, these businesses, you know, who are unfortunately nefarious in their ways are going to get away with it because they donate money. I think that it's a little bit more, there's a little bit more to that.
It's so much more than money, right? It's also the fact that these people are more regular voters, right? Because they have the opportunity to vote more. And there's a certain sociability too, to that. But, you know, the very idea that you can leave a job at any time you want, that's not real, right? That's depends on larger labor market conditions. People are finally, you know, there's an indicator called JOLTS, right? Which is the amount of times people leave their jobs. It's been flat for a very long time just because the economy as a whole has been bad. As soon as we started stimulating the economy with relief money, people started leaving their jobs because the economy tightened, right? Workers don't have all the same options as employers do in a capitalist economy. That's why capitalism works in many ways. But it just means it's not a perfect system. There are frictions, there are all kinds of problems, and the role of an efficient government is the role of the national interest to intervene in that. I've been talking a lot and very technically, so I apologize for that. But it just, you know, looking from the things in these little myopic clusters, it doesn't help when we need to think about big transformational changes. We need to be a lot braver than this.
This is perfect. This is exactly why we have you all as a roundtable. We need the contrasting in opinions. Rachel, I saw you had a comment, please.
Yeah, Yakov made me think about something with a lot of industries and businesses that are in the rural areas, particularly like corporate businesses. So, and it made me think about something. So my mother is from a small town in Arkansas called Helena, Arkansas. It's about 45 minutes from Memphis. And not too far from Helena is Bentonville, Arkansas, where Walmart was started. And we all know the descendants of the, forgot what's, but Daddy Walmart, if you want to say it like that, they are billionaires and they've doubled their wealth within the past year from, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic and everything else. But within Helena, Arkansas, there is, when I believe there's, it's like that in all small towns that I've been to, there's always a Walmart in these small towns. And I have a few family members who have been working at that Walmart for years and years and years. And it doesn't seem as if their pay has increased, but, you know, the corporate offices, their pay has increased. The CEOs, their pay has increased. So from that point of view, yes, I believe that the minimum wage can definitely go up in those areas, way past $15 an hour. I highly believe that because, you know, in those small towns, rent is probably no more than $850 for a nice two bedroom in those certain areas, because it's a small, when I tell you small town, very small town. So I believe that, you know, the corporate offices and the CEOs and the CFOs and all these other people are making their money, but that money could go to the workers to get paid way over the minimum wage now, which is $7.25. So they can at least get paid $14 or $15 an hour. And it could put them in a great place. But I believe we have to start holding these corporate businesses accountable, especially corporate businesses that are in small rural areas as well. So you made me think about that, you know, how the top of the food chain within the corporate businesses are making all this cash. They're rolling in dough, but their workers down to the janitor inside these businesses are making little to nothing. So that made me think about that. And I just want to put that out there that I actually see it. I've seen it in these small towns. So.
And you know, that's good for the small town because you don't just sit on your earnings like a dragon, right? You spend it in local businesses, and that makes it even harder. And you know, that's the virtuous cycle that makes it even harder for Walmart to charge low wages, because then there's more growth and more employment, right? But to get there, you actually have to have Walmart paying non-poverty wages, right? So people can spend and grow.
Correct.
It's great.
This conversation brings me to exactly where we want to be, and especially because we are quickly running out of time. And it's to understand from each of you what economic inequality means. Rachel, you just put out that contrast, this image of, you know, the corporate giants, the low-wage worker, and for a lot of participants and for a lot of people we interviewed in the podcast, that's what they described economic inequality as. But other people, depending on their lived experiences, as Rod shared and others, they were talking about inequality that was just systemic, that it's impossible to get out of, that no matter what we do, it's just, we're stuck. We're just in this constant cycle. And I would love for our listeners to hear about what you all think economic inequality means to you.
So I will say economic inequality to me means fighting for a seat at the table when there was never a seat for you reserved. And that can go for, you know, you could take it from any way you want to say, somebody coming from a rural area, a minority standpoint, depending on where you grew up at as well. Your yearly income type of people, depending on where you come from. But I feel like from my standpoint, I feel like I can agree, like I can mesh all of those areas together. Coming from as a Black woman who grew up in a lower middle class, due to my parents really doing what they had to do when, and their parents had nothing past an eighth grade education. I feel like it's more of a, you know, trying to make myself heard and seen so others can see what people like me go through or people in my community go through or what my family has experienced. But I have to, you know, and for me to make other people understand that it helps me and my people to move up in the world. And I know it taps into the racial inequality from it, but going from ancestors who helped build this country and some of my other side who were already here, indigenous family members, but, you know, trying to get a piece of the pie that I was never supposed to be shared with. And going to school to try to get where I want to be, but I know a lot of people like me could not go to school. You know, I had to, not had to, but I decided to join the military to help pay for college, undergrad, to help pay for law school. But a lot of my friends, they couldn't do so because they had to go home and help mom and dad, help raise their brother and sister and stuff like that. And I feel like they wanted to get a seat at the table too, so they can be heard. But I feel like for me, in my neighborhood, a lot of my friends look at me like, oh, you're the one. I'm like, no, don't say that. I'm speaking for all of us, man. Like, you know, so I feel like that's my definition of economic inequality, trying to get a seat at the table, but not really having that reserved seat for you. So everybody can understand how you feel and how to help others. So that's my.
Yeah, economic inequality, you know, it's quite a loaded term. At Stanford, where I'm also a student, you know, one of the things that we really push for is an interdisciplinary approach and understanding, bringing different people to the table and understanding why an issue is the way that it is. And so I'm, you know, when I think about economic inequality, it's not just, you know, what's going to your bank or what you're taking home every day. It's much broader than that. We have to understand why are these individuals in the situation that they're at in the first place, right? I mean, education comes to mind. You know, there's education disparities across the country. There's individuals in different districts that are being well prepared and others that aren't. And that's unfortunate. I think when it comes to the area that you live in, the zip code that you live in is also critical. I mean, the move towards artificial intelligence is interesting as well. But when we think about fair lending practices and not inserting bias into some of these algorithms that are making these decisions in terms of who can get a loan to go to college and who can't, right? Or so who can get a loan for a house and who can't, just based on, you know, numerical data. And so when I think about economic inequality, you know, I would take my definition a little bit further into, you know, what are the sources of that inequality itself? Because, you know, I think if we better understand that, I think economic inequality is the convergence of failed policy solutions kind of coming together. And this is the result. If we think about if we're going to uplift a population, you know, I'm a firm believer in education. I think everybody should have equal opportunity to get an education. You know, and the quality of education is going to vary from place to place. But, you know, for me, I think education is the key. I went to a community college before I transferred to Stanford. That was a conscious choice. I knew I wanted to go to grad school. I knew I wanted to do other things. So saving, you know, that large sum of money for me, that was an intentional choice. And now in California, if a first time community college student, you know, you can go there for free. For 2 years, right? The only thing that you really have to pay for is books, and there's programs to help with that. So, you know, it's, you know, Rachel's definition was quite interesting about, you know, that whole notion about, you know, trying to get to the table when you never even had that seat in the first place. But I think, you know, that's the unfortunate truth of a lot of our situations. And, you know, as a policymaker, my job is to really see, okay, well, how can we bring that table from that other room? And make sure that you didn't have a table then, we're gonna give you a table now. And really moving forward, I think is absolutely critical, but also remembering the past too. Just because you're moving forward doesn't mean you have to forget about the past. Keep that in mind when you're creating your decisions and really understanding the issue. But also I think it's important to keep in mind that there is this large focus from all these different angles. And thankfully, Stanford University has really drilled that in me class to class about really looking at it from a bird's eye view. So I would say, you know, that is my very broad definition of economic inequality. It's that convergence of all these failed policies that are leading to this inequality in the first place.
So, you know, for me, what I guess I've never thought about it, but as you guys are speaking, for me, it's lost potential. I'm a first generation American. I wasn't born in this country and I really love this country. I've achieved the American dream. And when I look at the problems of economic inequality, I look at them in the sense of lost opportunities for growth, for technical innovation, and generally miring this country in secular stagnation, right? We are not growing. We are now. We've had some very good policies. We should have some more, We have chained ourselves to preferences of a very some very small, very dominant sectors, and we are not using the firepower we have to get out of the situation. And honestly, that breaks my heart, because that means we're not going to prosper as a country. Right? Fixing economic inequality, it's not just about justice to the individual. It is about a higher growth, higher innovation economy. It's about a 21st century economy that can compete in the world. And we're just not doing that because of some very embedded local interests. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the Walton family of Walmart. I'm talking about local elites. I'm talking about your car dealers, your small doctors. We are not making the hard distributional choices we need to make in order to prosper.
Wow. Thank you so much. Each of you shared a lot about who you are, how you came to the views you hold, and provided such a rich discussion about these policies that not only do they seem far away from us, but we also deal with it daily in trying to make ends meet. And I'm sure that so many of our listeners today have walked away with a lot to think about in terms of where they stand on these important issues. And myself, I'm pretty inspired by some of the things that you've said. You know, Yakov, lost potential. That's deep right there. And trying to figure out how we stop letting potential leak through our own fingertips. How do we grab hold of that? But at the same time, maybe other listeners too feel pretty deflated about the fact that maybe minimum wage won't happen, maybe the UBI is going to go away, and maybe all the things we've talked about are just kind of aspirational. But I think the one thing that holds true is we have to figure out how to do it ourselves, find other people to work with us. And I think you've all shared ways for us to do that today. I'm so grateful that you've all taken time out of your day to speak with us and to share your thoughts. It's been so rich, and I think it's going to start a lot of really wonderful conversations to come. Thank you so much.
From the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University, the Berggruen Institute, and the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University, this has been Voices of Shaping Our Future. If you like our series, be sure to tell your friends to subscribe, and we encourage you to start your own conversations about the very topics we're discussing this season. The Voices of Shaping Our Future podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and is hosted by me, Alice Hsu. To learn more about me, you can find me on the Center for Deliberative Democracy's website, linked in the show notes. To learn more about the Berggruen Institute, or the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University, please visit their websites, also linked in the show notes. Voices of Shaping Our Future is produced by Scott Simpson and Amy Locker and edited by Josh Williams. This series is executive produced by the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University, the Berggruen Institute, the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University, and Toby Agency.